This is Jeff Spittler, March 10th, 2002, A Tale of Two Kingdoms, number 61. Was the Archbishop's death murder? Well, we come this morning to a somewhat difficult topic, or a controversial one, and we'll get to that in a minute. And, yesterday I was working hard and got running late on this home improvement project, so my wife had pity on me and made homemade cinnamon rolls with the girls' help to assuage the the anger of the class or whatever, or to divert them from worrying about what we were covering. So unfortunately for those of you listening on tape or the internet, you're out of luck. But pass those around, Brad. Yeah.
Dan, can you get a picture of one for the first
time? Yeah. Okay. Or maybe that's just to keep your mouth full while I'm talking about this topic. Okay, so last week we covered the increase of persecution, alternative church government, we might say, sort of field presbyteries, and conventicles from 1676 through 1678. The persecution went from letters of intercommuning onto the setting up of a new star chamber, sending ministers to prison on the Bass Rock, offering rewards so that any, say, bounty hunter could arrest almost anyone hoping for a fine. And it climaxed in 1678 with the raising of the Highlanders, who carried off everything, and we do mean everything, like a plague of locusts. We covered several meetings of field presbyteries and saw some dissension over how indulged ministers were treated. Many of the better-known field preachers wanted to close ranks and not preach against the indulgence or the indulged ministers, as many of them also did not wish to, wouldn't preach in the parish of an indulged minister. A smaller group insisted on preaching against it, with John Wellwood and Richard Cameron being among those. Finally, the size and frequency of conventicles continued to grow, with numbers as large as 14,000 being reported. However, the increasing size and frequency also meant that there were increasing numbers of run-ins with the law. For the most part, small groups of soldiers had refrained from attacking larger conventicles because of the obvious possibility that they might not prevail. But the confrontation started to become more common in around the 30th of March, 1679, I'm now looking to Simon to correct my pronunciation, Lesmahagow. He doesn't even recognize it. There's a blank look on his face. Okay, well, it's on the motorway between Glasgow and the south. A small party of soldiers arrested some latecomers. Okay, it wasn't on the motorway then, only now is it on the motorway. they arrested some latecomers. Some people were straggling in, presumably because they were afraid of attacking the main party. And they proceeded to strip some women and detain some men. Now, a common practice was to seize most, not all, as far as I'm aware, of the clothes of suspected conventiclers and leave them to make it home as best they could. One, I think it's Hewison that makes some comment that you can imagine James Graham, Claverhouse, this heroic war party carrying off, loads of petticoats and Bibles and the like, oh, such were the heroes of those days. When the main party got wind of this, however, they demanded that the prisoners be released, and a fray followed, which resulted in the capturing of the commanding lieutenant and seven of his men. Supposedly one of the Covenanters, William Castles, prevented another from executing this lieutenant on the spot, and this Castles later received a royal pardon for something because of this action. Okay, shortly thereafter, on the 3rd of May, 1679, one of the pivotal events of our church history occurs. And because it's such a pivotal event, and I know you all be interested in the details, I would like you to read I'll read you a fairly full account of this. Um, event. And like many, or we should say maybe most later writers, Hewison did not approve of the actions of this small band of Covenanters. And for that matter, a number of their contemporaries didn't approve either. But I'm getting ahead of myself there, so. Okay. The atrocious procedure and vile acts of Carmichael, deputy to the sheriff principal of Fife, the Earl of Rose, were no longer endurable by the wanderers in Fife, whose feelings were outraged by the tales of robberies, rapes, adulteries, and other sins of the flesh, as well as of torture by match and maltreating of women and children indulged in by the agents of the crown. During the month of April 1679, about 20 men, including David Haxton of Rathillet, met in Gilston, Leslie, and other places to pray and to consider probable action. The hapless Sharp was now devoted for sacrifice, at least by the determination of some of these outlaws. Since January, before the execution of Mitchell, several godly men had been dogging the primate between St. Andrews and Edinburgh. Twice he narrowly escaped their sinister intentions, and other worthy Christians had used means to get him upon the road before. The zealots at several meetings discussed the subject of the removal of Sharp and Carmichael and concluded it to be their duty to hang both of them over the port, much as Cardinal Beaton had been treated. Russell and other conspirators, feeling impulses to do something, consulted the oracle and the scriptures and confessed, having gotten encouragement therein for their homicidal mania. John Balfour of Kinloch, alias Captain Burley, declared he was prevented fleeing to the Highlands, and on asking God's mind was turned back with these words, "Go and prosper." Then he got this divine commission from Scripture, "Go, have I not sent thee?" And he dared no longer question. Smith, a godly weaver in Strutherdike, prayed, then oracularly observed that if God wished it, he would place the persecutors in the avenger's way. The result of these deliberations was a desire for an assize on horseback with Haxton at their head if he would take command. It was also agreed to invite two stalwart fighters for the cause, then absent John Balfour and John Henderson. On Friday, 2nd May, the 13 conspirators met on the moor near Gilston, and after discharging a weak associate, the lucky number proceeded to Baldini to spend the night. Robert Black's wife, there was a veritable Judith encouraging the desperados, one of whom gave her a holy kiss at parting when she replied, "If Long Leslie, minister at Ceres, be with him, Sharp, lay him on the green also." "There is the hand that shall do it," was the response of the gallant. Early in the morning, a scout was dispatched and returned to report that Sheriff Carmichael, who loved to hunt a hare as well as to run a wig to earth, was already riding with his dogs to Tarvet Hill. A party mounted and rode the hill to find that Carmichael, warned by a shepherd, had gone back to Cupar. He had realized his peril. A night or two before, Haxton had fixed on the door of Cupar School a discharge to all parties, buying Carmichael's pointed goods, thereby putting the people in reverence of Whig reprisals. When the scattered conspirators met again to consider the next move, a boy appeared up with a message from Mrs. Black to the effect that the coach of the Archbishop was passing between Ceres and Blibahol. They saw it and exclaimed, "Truly, this is of God. It seemeth that God hath delivered him into our hands." All except Haxton avowed a clear call to kill, or in their fatalistic terminology, to execute the justice of God on the murder of his saints. Haxton had scruples. There was, quote, "a known prejudice betwixt the bishop and him," so that his intervention now would, quote, "mar the glory of the action." When he refused to lead the band of nine in the chase, Balfour cried, "Gentlemen, follow me." This bold avenger was described at Haxton's trial as a lay broad man, round, ruddy-faced, dark brown hair, and had a brown horse, armed with holster pistols and a shable, or sword. Haxton followed his brother-in-law on a white horse. We turn to the intended victim. He had done his worst for the covenant he had sworn, his utmost against the faithful maintainers of it. His untiring assiduity in wiping out what he called the gangrene of dissent had its most striking illustration on Thursday, the 1st of May, when he attended the Privy Council for the last time. He was one of 26 legislators who sat that day revising and authorizing sanguinary measures. One of these was a proclamation against being in arms at Field Conventicles, afterwards published on 13th May. The order virtually empowered any officer of the crown, the meanest justice of the peace or youngest subaltern, to seize, try for treason, and execute on the spot any suspected conventicler carrying any, quote, "weapon invasive." The primate, it was said, contemplated going to London to have the latest repressive legislation sanctioned, and this may have been one of the, quote, "papers of moment" found when his coach was ransacked. It was an iniquitous act quite to be expected at the end of a reptilious career, and a suitable accompaniment for the French pistols which this high priest carried along with his pictorial Bible. On the 2nd May, the primate, his daughter Isabella, and 5 servants with a stagecoach drawn by 6 horses reached the village of Kennaway, where Captain Seaton entertained them for the night. On Saturday afternoon, the equipage halted at the manse of Sarah's, where the social prelate had a comforting pipe with Long Leslie. As they proceeded homeward, Sharp grew nervous as he approached Miller's farm at Magus, and said to his daughter, "There lives an ill-natured man. God preserve us, my child." It was a timorous presentiment. At noon, the coach rumbled up to the ridge where Magus Moor slopes down into green Strathkinnis inside of the Cathedral Towers of St. Andrews, 3.5 miles away. The band of 9 execrable fanatical assassinates, as the hue and cry described them, were seen galloping, pistols in hand and naked shables gleaming in the sun looped to their right wrist. The other 3, James and Alexander Balfour and Gilston and Thomas Ness, did not join the assassins. Suspecting their evil design, the prelate frantically urged coachman and postillion to drive, drive, drive. Balfour, Russell, Henderson, and others fired at the fleeing coach, then threw their pistols and cloaks on the ground. Slashing the faces of horses and postillions, hamstringing the leaders, and cutting the traces, they soon held up the coach. With execrations, "Dog, villain, apostate, murderer of Mitchell, Guthrie, and Learmont," they ordered him to come forth, Judas. He descended, yet unwounded. More probably, Balfour's last shot at the standing coach gave him the only gunshot wound he got. The premeditated, informal assize proceeded on the moorland, and the fierce accusers, hurling impeachments and taunts at the defenseless prisoner, in imitation of the council's method, were prosecutor, jury, judge, and executioners in turn. Asseverating that he never wronged man, he piteously begged his life. They told him to repent and prepare for death, judgment, and eternity, and bade him pray. He would not pray, or in the circumstances could not. Assuming a judicial error, Balfour said that no spleen moved them. Sharp, murderer, betrayer, and enemy of Christ, must die. On his knees, he looked up into the squinting eyes of little Balfour, fierce looking with his 10 weeks beard, and probably recognized that beggared heritor, said, "You are a gentleman. Have pity on my poor child here and spare her life. And for this, sir, give me your hand." Balfour's reply was a slash on his upturned face before he wrote him down. Another account makes Sharp crawl to the feet of Haxton, who answered his entreaty, "Sir, I shall never lay a hand on you." At the sight of the cold steel, the archbishop shrieked. His daughter rushed between the avenging blades and her father and was wounded, too. According to this account, other accounts say she wasn't wounded. With fiendish delight, Russell recorded the brutalities, usually attributed to Balfour, which he himself perpetrated. Guillon, who held the horses, implored the slayers to spare the old man's life and was threatened by Balfour. He appealed to Haxton, who mounted on horseback, his cloak about his mouth, stood by looking on at the tragedy. But that one pious, godly youth refused to interfere. At length, William Dingwall gave the victim the final thrust, and Russell exultingly exclaimed, "Take up your priest now." Wallace, one of the attendants, made a gallant defense before he was cut down. The dead man's pockets were rifled. The coach and baggage were next ransacked. They found state papers, a Bible, a talisman, a tobacco box, out of which flew a humming bee, supposed to be his, quote, familiar, some nail parings, probably used for scaring witches, a case of pistols, and a few trifles belonging to his daughter. So, there's a little footnote on what wounds his post-mortem examination showed. But I won't get into that. Okay. As I said, many of his contemporaries didn't approve. He was, in quotes, Judge Brodie. And Brodie had been one of the commissioners of the Church of Scotland who had gone over to get to negotiate with Charles back in around 1651, with Charles II. He was later made some kind of judge, like a Supreme Court judge or that sort of thing. Brodie wrote in his diary, "I heard that the Bishop of St. Andrews was killed. It grieved my soul to hear that any professing real grace should fall in such an act. I abhor it perfectly." Notice he didn't say he didn't really abhor the bishop getting killed. He did abhor that people claiming to be Christians did it. Hewison notes that, as was to be expected, the Covenanters were divided into 2 parties when considering the justifiableness of the execution of Sharp by self-constituted judges. The extremists, such as the author of A Hind Let Loose, defending, and other sufferers reprobating it. Wadrow mentions the fact that the Scots congregation in Rotterdam would not allow the outlawed Balfour to have fellowship with them in the communion on account of his indefensible life and character. Shields said, and this is after he was talking about the way that James Mitchell had been treated, how he'd been promised his life and then Sharp perjured himself and had him killed. Shields, writing at the time, said, "But justice would not suffer this murderer to pass long unrevenged, nor that truculent traitor, James Sharp, the arch-prelate, who was the occasion and cause of it, and of many more, both before and after, to escape remarkable punishment. The severity whereof did sufficiently compense its delay after 10 years' respite, wherein he ceased not more and more to pursue, persecute, and make havoc of the righteous for their duty, until at length he received the just demerit of his perfidy, perjury, apostasy, sorceries, villainies, and murders, sharp arrows of the mighty and coals of juniper. For upon the 3rd of May, 1679, several worthy gentlemen, with some other men of courage and zeal for the cause of God and the good of the country, executed righteous judgment upon him in Magus Moor near St. Andrews." Okay, despite Shields having such what maybe are scandalous opinions, he was still readmitted to the post-revolution church and served as a missionary. So, well, was it murder? I know you want to hear the definitive answer from me. since I'm quite sure it'll be a topic of intense interest, I thought I might rehearse a few of the arguments for and against it. First, though, we might agree that at the least he deserved it. You could point to a number of things that he did, but he gave false testimony in a capital case, resulting in the execution of a man. From a biblical standpoint, that's a capital offense. Not to mention being a despot who oversaw the persecution, torture, and execution of a number of Christians. He was the chief instigator of the executions after the Pentland Rising and was reported to have withheld a letter from the king that would have ordered them be stopped. And I imagine that most of us would be no more troubled by all this, having caught up with him, than we were upset when Nicolae Ceaușescu, was shot, or other, sort of despot dictators of the 20th century. But that isn't the issue here. I mean, the real question is whether or not a private party could execute him. And so we might set aside the some arguments against killing him. Depend on, would claim that he didn't deserve it or something. Well, skip over theirs. But the other ones that we might more seriously consider are those that this is a private party with no authority to take up the sword of state. It's difficult to gainsay this argument. One can imagine the chaos that would result if we all decide to individually usurp the role of state. You can also imagine the temptations that would come with taking up the sword yourself, or the temptations to take up the sword yourself. It's not just a historical argument. Even today, this makes, I think, a valid argument against shooting of abortionists or bombing of abortion clinics. But would it make such a good argument in places like Sudan, where Christians have been facing years and years of intense persecution? Perhaps not. Another argument against killing a Sharp was based on pragmatic considerations. After Sharp was killed, the persecution got much hotter. It seems likely that his killing was the trigger for further persecution. On the other hand, it's difficult to prove conclusively that that's true. The persecution was getting hotter and might have even been worse had Sharp still been around. The two arguments for the killing of Sharp are really based on two things. One is special circumstances. There was no justice in the land or any hope of getting any. And the other is self-defense, or extended version of self-defense. And really, almost all later writers condemn this this murder, but I did find this one article. I think, if I understand correctly, I found it on the web, so I didn't find it in the original source, but it was published, I believe, in 1860. I'm a little unclear. I found it on the covenanter.org website. I think it may have been published in the original Covenanter, that magazine. But, and the writer here is unknown. So, the special circumstances argument, midway through, he says, "Of course, we are here met with the assertion that though Sharp deserved to die, it was nevertheless murder in Covenanters to put him to death. Few writers, however, trouble their readers with reasons for such a decision, and perhaps they find a difficulty in mustering any. We cannot but think a very different verdict should be given. Under ordinary circumstances, it might indeed be unnecessary and inexpedient for any but the appointed officers to execute justice on murderers. The general consequence of a contrary course might perhaps be evil. We are not maintaining that such a viperous bishop as Sharpe should not be punished in any other way than he was. What we contend for is that they should by all means be punished and that circumstances alter cases. While anything approximating to justice is dispensed by a public tribunal, let it be administered in that manner. But if justice cannot be thus obtained, if the public tribunal instead of justice dispenses injustice, if this is not occasionally but generally the case, if judges and bishops are banded together to rob, murder, and oppress, and systematically send to the block men they should honorably acquit, and so act that he who dare raise the voice of complaint or presume to impeach the guilty would beyond all question endanger his own neck, then we manifest that the sooner the land rids itself of such men by the summary infliction of justice, the better. Let justice be done, in the regular manner if possible, but anyway, let it be done. Better 1,000 times that it should be irregularly inflicted on 2, 20, or 100 murderers than that honest men should be slaughtered by them like so many sheep. Sharpe's case was a plain one. To his numberless other villainies, he had added that of putting 9 men to death contrary to the express command of his master, and he had continued oppressing and plotting against every good man and true from that onward. No lengthened consideration was needed. Wild justice was all that he deserved and was all that was possible. And we deny the necessity under all circumstances of a public tribunal sitting, receiving evidence, deciding on the guilt of the criminal, and then inflicting punishment. It was not so in the case of the man slain by Phinehas, and yet his conduct was approved. It was not so in the case of Ehud, who slew Eglon. Nor was it so in the best and palmiest days of the Jewish commonwealth. When a man was murdered, no court met or judges sat before the avenger of blood dare lift up his arm. As soon as he learned the deed was done, he started in hot pursuit of the murderer, and wherever he overtook him in his flight to the city of refuge, he smote him prostrate in the dust so that he never rose. This was justice in the very manner, too, sanctioned and prescribed by God. And now as then, and in Scotland as in everywhere else, the voice of nature and the nearest relatives and friends is to avenge a brother's death by the immediate slaughter of his murderers. This feeling is the legitimate, faithful working of that constitution God has given us, and if this right had been yielded up to and centered in a magistrate, it was not irrevocable. If he refused to exercise it, they may and must appoint another. If he pardoned the guilty and condemned the righteous willfully and systematically, they might depose him, peaceably if they could, by force if they could not. What? Resist the magistrate? Yes, by all means. Resist, rebel, exact justice without the usual formalities is as better than no justice. It is not making matters worse than they were, for such is the treatment they and their compatriots have been receiving. And extreme circumstances are not to be judged by ordinary times. They are a law unto themselves. Forbearance is no longer a duty. Endurance ceases to be a virtue. And he who first strikes the tyrant does the greater service to religion and humanity. And he goes on to the self-defense argument. Let's see. The right of self-defense in a right man never entirely relinquishes under any government. A man may be attacked in open day, and if his life is endangered, of which he only can be the judge, he may kill his assailant. And under different circumstances, this permission is extended. Should a man forcibly attempt to enter your house at midnight, you are at liberty to shoot him, because he may not probably murder you before he leaves. In other words, where government does not, cannot, or will not protect you, you must protect yourself. Let's see, and then he goes on from there. This goes on pretty long, so I won't try to read it, but basically making the argument that this was, in fact, a self-defense, if maybe in sort of an aggregate sense. So, also, for those of you, some of you would be interested by this aside later on, But moreover, we say, no such acts do not encourage assassination any more than the summary proceedings of the Avenger of Blood or the acts of Ehud, or the Revolution of 1688 and the American Revolution encourage assassination, rebellion, and revolution. So, I think it seemed like somewhere else here he went on more about the American Revolution. I guess that wasn't... Well, we'll leave that aside. So. Anyways, if you're interested, I can point you to the web address for it. Of course, as you probably have already guessed, the Privy Council was outraged. I mean, one of their members had been killed. Although I'm not sure personally they really cared that much about Sharpe, but they issued a hue and cry, which we've all heard this term, hue and cry, and what I can tell, it refers to an official proclamation here, that offered fairly sizable rewards for the suspects. Their names were written in red, maybe in blood. Landowners in Fife were ordered to present all their tenants for interrogation. Anyone who was absent or any landowner who failed to do this would be assumed to have approved of Sharp's killing and been declared to be art and part of it. Another proclamation forbade anyone from carrying arms without a license. The assailants made their way to the west of Scotland, where they met up with Robert Hamilton. Hamilton, who we met last week, was an organizer of the resistance. He was a friend and supporter of Richard Cameron. And let me just take a few minutes to turn aside and discuss Richard Cameron. He rises up to prominence about this time. And let me also, again, recommend this biography, The Lion of the Covenant, The Story of Richard Cameron by Maurice Grant. It's very interesting reading. And you don't even have to go to a rare bookstore to find it. Cameron had been licensed to preach in the spring of 1678, but this was a probationary license. He was under the authority of those who had licensed him, including John Welsh. Cameron started to become a stench in the other field preachers' nostrils when he insisted on preaching the indulgence. As I mentioned last week, there began to be a rift over this issue. Most of the field preachers thought unity was more important than truth, or maybe more important at least than preaching on the indulgence. The disapproval was exacerbated and the stench made worse when John Brown of Wamphray, the exiled minister in Holland, wrote to Cameron encouraging him in his preaching. Short excerpt from the letter here. "Dear brother, though I have," this is to Cameron, "though I have no acquaintance, yet the report I have heard of your appearing for Christ in his cause. Now when so many are not so zealous as sometimes they were thought to have been, and particularly the report I have heard of the Lord employing of you to hold up his banner in dead and desolate Annandale, and blessing your labors there as elsewhere, so that a great change is wrought, and among the rest in and among the people of Wamphray Parish, where alas I did little or no good, blessed be he who honoreth himself and carrieth on his work by what instruments he will, hath excited me to write this line of hearty thanks for my part. But you know whom you serve, and you know what a rich and great recompense of reward is awaiting, out of pure grace such as are honored to carry on his work as co-workers with him. Besides the inconceivably great honor that is in the service itself, and the rich incomes and supplies of new strength, furniture, peace and joy in the Holy Ghost that attend the faithful, endeavor to lay out ourselves to the uttermost in singleness of heart for him and his service. I have likewise heard of the trouble you have met with at the hands of some, and of whom sometime other things were expected, because of your faithful and zealous, yea, and seasonable appearing against that woeful indulgence, the evil that God's soul hateth. I bless the Lord that helped you to stand in that day of trial. Stand fast, my dear brother, and speak freely and boldly. Fear not." So, at this time, and there were very few sort of Cameronian ministers in Scotland. Most of them were against Cameron for preaching the indulgence. John Brown also wrote Welsh, and he said, "My dear brother, I was surprised to hear that you were among those who would not speak against that piece of defection, nor preach if the tent were set but one length of your staff within their bounds," okay, within the bounds of a parish that had an indulged minister, "and that even upon a weekday when called to countenance a fast. This looks so unlike you in your usual way of following the call of God that I could not but impute it more to some others influencing you than to your own genius and inclination. I am loath to tell you my fears that if you go on in this course, your testimony is near an end." Well, naturally, if these sorts of letters, in one sense, I mean, it didn't help Cameron from the standpoint of his standing with the other ministers. They objected to his preaching on the indulgence, and they issued an indictment against him, charging him with exceeding the terms of his license by preaching without sufficient supervision and with preaching on the indulgence. He was twice called to submit to presbyterial discipline and instruction in November and December of 1678. At the first meeting, Cameron came with others who supported him, including Robert Hamilton. And Hamilton was widely regarded as an interloper and troublemaker, and Maurice Grant quotes David Williamson complaining against laymen, ignorant, idle men who had taken upon them to meddle in the matter of church government without a call. I don't know if that's... you know, at various times in the Scottish church, there was a sort of an anti-lay elder view among the ministers, and I was wondering if that was that coming out. John Brown of Wanfrey wrote additional letters where he rejected the authority of those presbyteries, field presbyteries, to limit Cameron's preaching. It is perhaps ironic that they were insisting that no General Assembly had condemned the indulgence, and therefore he couldn't preach against it, while also being true that no General Assembly had condemned preaching against the indulgence. So how are they to tell him he couldn't preach on it? Maurice Grant comments, Cameron, however, was by no means without his supporters. While the older people in the main remained largely influenced by the ministers, the sympathies of the young were undoubtedly with Cameron. His stand at Dunscourt earned their admiration, and his uncompromising opposition to the indulgence he had caught much of the prevailing mood. Among the young at this time, many of them recent converts, there was growing disillusionment with the policies of the older ministers, and with their desire for an accommodation with those who had accepted an indulgence. It was increasingly felt that the church had not proved true to the testimony of the reformers, or even that to the earlier victims of the persecution. This extended not only to the martyrs such as James Guthrie, but to the exiles such as McWard and Brown. Cameron was wont to justify his stand in terms of the Reformation standards and the covenants, and this carried a strong appeal for many who looked nostalgically back to the testimony of the church in her best days. For then, Cameron became the focus of a new radicalism, offering the prospect of returning the church to a Reformation purity. Okay. Cameron continued preaching during the spring of 1679. He was widely in demand. He left Scotland in early May, it is thought, to travel to Holland. And while the specific purpose of the trip is unknown, I think it must have at least had something to do along the lines of, at the very least, have had fellowship with these Scottish ministers in Holland. McWard had previously reserved judgment on Cameron based on what he knew before he met Cameron. This is actually this happens more than once. In Cameron's career, where somebody who had heard about him, you know, said an instinctive dislike, and then when they actually met him, they found him to be quite different. McWard later wrote, "The common report of poor Mr. Cameron was that not only did he preach nothing but babble against the indulgence, but that he could do no other thing. And this was so confidently and commonly talked that I was not in the case to contradict it upon knowledge. But by his coming hither, the reporters have lost their credit. And many who heard him were convinced that prejudice, heightened to malice, had given men liberty to talk so. For here he was found a man of savory gospel spirit, the bias of his heart lying towards the proposing of Christ and persuading to a closing with him." I read this, I couldn't help but thinking in our own day of some people that we've known, Greg Bonson, for example, not to say same as Richard Cameron, but simply, you know, here's a man that you could hear many people talk illy of. Yet if you met him, I think he was very clearly a man of a savory gospel spirit. McWard had studied under Samuel Rutherford. He had been Rutherford's secretary at the Westminster Assembly. He'd known many of the other leading figures of the Second Reformation. He and John Brown, who also had known Rutherford, strongly approved of Richard Cameron. And before he returned to Scotland, they ordained him to the ministry. This is a bit unusual, and actually, we'll cover it later, because some of this actually hinges on the event, things that are going on in Scotland. So, let's see. Well, I actually believe I have more material, but I don't think I better stop there to leave ample time for questions and discussions. I'm sure this, you know, was the bishop's death murder, you know, will be something you'll want to discuss at length. So, any questions? What? This class is going to talk about whether or not the bishop's death was murder? Oh, whew. Mr. Wilkinson.
We read from the argument of why it was considered valid in self-defense or being a not a constituted authority. The other side was, it was probably the majority voice, was saying that what they did was wrong, and that they were not a duly constituted body to carry out the judgment.
Right. Seems to have been the majority opinion. So, sort of a galvanizing event too. So I'm not sure what the opinion was the day before or what it would have been, but the argument against is that, you know, you're basically taking up the sword in your own hands, right? And you know, even today we have this you know, if you look at our own legal system here, thankfully, unlike our friends in the United Kingdom, we still have a right to self-defense. You know, and even lethal forms of self-defense. But as you all know, you can take it too far. You know, and I can assure you, under today's legal system, that Sharpe's murder would have considered taking it too far. Right? So I mean, you can shoot somebody if they're in your house or there's some, you know, reasonable imminent threat, but you can't just go around shooting people who, you know, you know, we're likely to do you in later. So, Mary. Well, the persecution heated up, and there was another indulgence, and a lot, basically almost all the field preachers quit field preaching. But at the same time, those who refused, who maintained the same position, became increasingly seen as very radical. Right, so it again had the effect. I mean, I guess you could, in any situation where people are divided, when I said galvanizing, I didn't mean that they were all then ready to take action, but rather that a certain number of them basically decided that was too much and you know, quit going to field, quit hearing field preachers and so on. So, but for the rest, for those that remained, they had to really sort of take an even stronger stand. So eventually, within a year, denying the authority of the king, I mean, completely. Whereas before, we've always noticed how they, you know, always tended to uphold the authority of the king and say we're, you know, blaming it on bad advisors and so on. Well, finally, they just said the king's a despot. And you know. So.
History shown that this was an event that accelerated the persecution, but also accelerated the eventual reestablishment of the church.
Well, I don't know if you could really argue that specifically from this one event whether or not it did. I mean, if things are moving in a sense to a very rapid conclusion, we're now within 10 years of where basically the Scottish estates are going to take almost this very view that of James. They're going to say he's a despot, he's a papist, he didn't take the coronation oath of office, you know, correctly, and so on, and therefore, you know, God has given us William, King William, you know, and they're going to accept William, and they're going to use much the same line of reasoning that the hardline covenanters did. So, I think in some respects they were just ahead of their time. But Mr. Edmondson, I could tell you have a.
The Reformation model of reform and always reforming. and it seemed that if that was followed, the Reformation was going to sense more power and so forth. It would seem to me that Hammond's position has been stronger than the older.
Okay, well, to answer your first question, actually Cameron, when he preached on that subject of the indulgences and when he defended himself before these church, you know, field church courts, he did often reference the documents of the Reformation and the covenants. And I, you know, one suspects that one of the reasons why these field preachers, you know, didn't like him preaching on the indulgences, besides the pragmatic view that, you know, that was going to cause division, was also that he was reminding them of their own defection from the covenants. You know, it's hard. You sort of read what people did. Even this, even Welsh, seemed like he tried. You know, several times he went back and forth, and he had chastised Cameron, and he tried to get back, you know, reconciled with him, but there finally came a day when he had he had Cameron preach, and he preached against the defection and the indulgences, and Welsh got mad and came up and preached against him. That was it. So yeah, he definitely, you know, consciously hearkened back to the reformers and the covenants, so on. So that was your first question. On the second part, I'm not sure about the always reforming business. That's still, you still hear that. I don't know. My own view is that, you know, the Cameron did have the stronger position, but, you know, by far. And I think later events prove that out. So, you know, to what degree it had anything to do with always reforming, I'm not sure. But yes.
So, but it seems that if a person thinks about that, you would think that a normal Christian life at least should be continuing to be sanctified, that the continuation be becoming more and more aware of the truth. But it seems that, and they think that is not the case. The older leadership, not speaking about this, but the older leadership is so liberal. And how is it just mean that what actually occurs is exactly what we should do. If we understand this correctly, this is what the sanctification process should take place. But it seems like after a certain period of time, the older leadership is set in place and they become liberal. They fall for it.
Well, it does seem to often be the case, and I think you can almost read, I mean, you pretty much read that here. Even with the attitudes, as Maurice Grant points out, with the attitudes of the people, where the and it does seem to be a common occurrence. And no, I don't have a good can't say exactly why that is. I mean, obviously, people sometimes get tired of fighting the good fight, maybe as much as anything else. But and it becomes at some point easier. You know, if you get too tired, it becomes easier to accommodate than to maintain a stand. So, but. That's by no means unique to this situation. I think it clearly happens again and again. Is there another question over here? Okay. Well, let's close in prayer. Brian, would you close?